This is WMUK's West Southwest. I'm Gordon Evans. Coming up, we'll talk with Western Michigan University Thomas M. Cooley Law School Professor Paul Carrier about net neutrality and municipal broadband. But first, state lawmakers return to the Capitol in Lansing next week. We have some hints of what legislative leaders are hoping to do in the year ahead. We'll get a more detailed agenda from Governor Rick Snyder when he gives his final State of the State address, January 23rd. To give us an idea of what to expect in the year ahead in state government as well as politics, we turn to the Michigan Public Radio Network's Capitol Bureau Chief, Rick Pluta. He joins us from the MPRN studios in Lansing. Thanks for being with us, Rick.
Hello.
So let's begin with what House Speaker Tom Leonard and Senate Majority Leader Arlen Meekoff have spelled out. They had some different ideas in a story that Shana Roth filed this week. Is there any real tension there between what, say, the House Speaker, the Senate Majority Leader, and the Governor, Rick Snyder, want to get done? And is that perhaps exacerbated by the fact that all three of them are term limited from their current offices?
Well, I would say that there is always a certain amount of tension between the House and the Senate and the governor's office in terms of, differing priorities. But, they are all Republicans. And what their MO has been to date is, the three of them get together and they meet and they've all got their lists and they just kind of talk about them until they find some places where they can agree enough that everyone puts the same thing on their list. And I see no reason why that would be any different going into the final year of the term and the final year of Governor Rick Snyder's time in office. But you're absolutely right that, on the one hand, Rick Snyder and Arlen Meekoff are kind of done, and it seems like they're approaching the end of their political careers. But Tom Leonard certainly has aspirations. He wants to be the Attorney General nominee of the Republican Party, and so that might play a part in, what he pushes for. And another thing, too, is, they'll all have their lists of what they want to do and sometimes not do, but a lot of the legislative session, I think, is going to be determined by what happens in Washington. The legislature is going to have to make some changes to the Michigan tax code in order to make sure that taxpayers don't take a hit under the new federal tax code, make sure that people aren't bumped into higher tax brackets. We could see an infrastructure package coming out of Washington, which would certainly affect what the legislature is up to. And, the list kind of goes on.
One of the things that Senator Arlen Meekoff has mentioned is contamination of groundwater.
Mm-hmm.
Is this an issue which is kind of maybe getting on the radar rather quickly because of some high-profile incidents in the state and maybe gets magnified a little bit more because of Flint and, of course, the contamination with the lead pipes?
Yeah, that there is a nexus, I suppose, since, we're dealing in both instances with contamination of drinking water. What we're talking about with these, I won't try to pronounce the full chemical name, but they're called PFASs or PFASs, and that's an acronym. And we saw, in Western Michigan where Wolverine Worldwide contaminated groundwater by Rockford. But, these contamination sites are actually found all over the state. And so, pretty much every legislator, certainly every senator, has a contaminated site in his or her district. And so there's some pressure to get something done. And that's true in both the House and the Senate, that there is interest in dealing with this.
Does it seem likely that there is going to be a vote at some point this year on changing the law regarding carrying a gun in a school building?
Yes, that has already cleared the Senate, and now it's sitting in the House Judiciary Committee, and they're trying to work through some differences between basically the Senate version and largely what school superintendents say they want. School superintendents say that it should be up to them to determine whether or not guns are appropriate in schools. And some of them even argue that under federal law, they have that authority regardless of what the state does with its gun laws. What they're seeking to do is to close a loophole that's created a kind of bizarre situation where concealed guns are banned in schools. However, and as are most people openly carrying firearms, however, the way the law is written, if you have a concealed pistol permit, you may openly carry in schools. And so the chairman of the House Judiciary Committee, Jim Runstead from over in Oakland County, says that, you know, the options are, you could leave it as it is, although nobody really wants that, that you could allow concealed guns in schools but not open carry, maybe requiring people who are concealed carrying to check in at the office or something like that. And the Senate Majority Leader, Arlen Meekoff, also sees this as an opportunity to maybe get rid of what are being called gun-free zones, churches, stadiums, hospitals, places like that, so that people could, with concealed pistol permits, could carry pretty much anywhere.
Is there work left to be done on the issue of the state unemployment agency? This was an issue that kind of bubbled up to the surface in 2017. There was legislation passed, but is there still a question left of compensating people who were wrongly flagged for fraud?
Yes, that is still a question that is hanging out there. And, you know, it's Republicans have been, you know, hanging back on this particular issue while they try and at least make sure that we don't have these sort of false accusations of people fraudulently taking unemployment claims and fixing that while leaving the question of compensating the people who are actually hurt by this hanging out there.
So there's a number of issues that we haven't even covered that I'm sure will come up at some point during 2018.
Mm-hmm. Well, there will be surprises.
There's always surprises. I guess the question is, though, it is an election year and a big election year for Michigan because the governor's office is up. And of course, it will be a new governor because Rick Snyder's term limited. The top state offices, Attorney General, Secretary of State, the state Senate. Of course, all the state house. So, you know, you've watched this for a long time, Rick. When you hit a big election year like this, does it mean that legislation gets slowed down, that not as many issues can be covered because there's a lot of time spent campaigning, et cetera?
It's both a question of time and controversy, that the further you get into an even-numbered year, and especially one like this one where kind of everything is up, then the further you get into it, the harder it is to get something done, especially controversial things. And so we will see the legislature sort of, you know, blasting through trying to get the state budget wrapped up in a speedy fashion, deal with the tax issues that we talked about, maybe a couple of other things. And then, you know, the controversial stuff, the leaders will try to move it quickly if they can, but they understand that at some point they will run into the brick wall that is the election season.
So speaking of the election, we are speaking on Wednesday, not too long after hearing word that former state Supreme Court Chief Justice Bob Young is dropping out of the race for United States Senate. How surprising is this news?
Well, we're seeing a sorting out. He says that even though he considered himself the front runner, I don't know, front runners typically don't drop out, right, that what the Republicans need if they're going to have a credible chance of unseating Debbie Stabenow, the Democratic incumbent, they're going to have to coalesce behind a candidate and pretty quickly and avoid a fractious and expensive primary. So it seems like the direction that they're moving in is a John James, military veteran, a successful business person, well, inherited the family business, and African American. And so they're hoping that, along with the fact that he has not sought a political office before, might prove to be the refreshing change that voters might want in 2018.
After the 2016 election, when President Trump, amongst other things, of course, won Michigan's electoral votes in a very close race, a lot of Republicans were talking about turning the state a brighter shade of red, perhaps, not so purple or blue anymore, and, of course, targeting Debbie Stabenow's seat in the United States Senate. But a number of high-profile Republicans, including West Michigan Congressman Fred Upton, have passed on this Senate race, and now Bob Young Jr. dropping out. Does it indicate that maybe this race looked a little more promising a year ago than it does right now for Republicans?
I think that you could make that argument. And, of course, the wild card in this is Donald Trump and how people are perceiving the job that they see that he's doing and what we're seeing out of the congressional Republican leadership. And that will certainly affect enthusiasm, voter turnout, and that's the way that elections work now. It's basically a matter matter of nailing down your base and then getting them to the polls on election day. And so a lot of it will really lean on how voters in Michigan are viewing things in Washington, D.C., and that's going to apply even to these state offices.
Yeah. So, for instance, we've got a race for governor and still have to determine yet who the nominees will be for both parties. But is the governor's race one? If we look at Michigan history, it seems as though when the president is one party, Michigan tends to elect the governor from the other party that's not in the White House. Is that something that, again, now are we in a new age, though, with Donald Trump in the White House, that maybe the old political rules change when it comes to things like races for governor, Congress, et cetera?
That really is the question, that, that typically the party in the White House, and this is true not just in Michigan but across the country, typically the party in the White House struggles in these midterm elections, especially if you've got a controversial president, and we have a very controversial president. But Donald Trump's supporters say that, he breaks the rules, and there's certainly, a sense of that. We saw in the last election that people who didn't like Donald Trump were still willing to vote for Donald Trump. We'll see how that applies in 2018.
Are there other races in particular, Rick, that you are really keeping an eye on and expecting to be hotly contested, expensive, and will probably draw outsized interest, maybe even beyond the borders of Michigan, from national groups?
We've got a couple of open congressional seats. At least one of them will be competitive, and that's David Trott's seat in Oakland County, anchored in Oakland County, Southeast Michigan. We'll see if Democrats can make a challenge against either and or Mike Bishop and Tim Walberg. That those are targeted seats by Democrats, and so we'll be looking and seeing what that happens. And a lot of it is just trying to get a sense of whether or not we're going to face another wave.
And for the first time in a couple of years, we appear to be likely to have a pretty hotly contested ballot proposal.
Yeah.
In Michigan. The redistricting campaign seems to have its signatures ready, and it looks like it is in pretty good shape to make the ballot,
they still have to be certified, yeah.
Still have to be certified, and then there's probably going to be a court challenge, right?
That Republicans in the state chamber of commerce have made no secret that that not just that they're against this, but they're going to try and keep it off the ballot. It seems the most likely route that they will take is to challenge this proposed amendment to the state constitution as too sweeping, as reaching into too many different parts of the state constitution, so that it's not really an amendment so much as a constitutional convention on the ballot. That's the argument that they'll make. We'll see if it sticks.
Assuming it does make the ballot, how hotly contested will this be, and how much will we see money poured into both sides of this trying to support the change to how we do redistricting in Michigan, and how much to try and keep things the way they are?
It will be fierce and it will be expensive. But Republicans are aware that this issue seems to have captured the public's attention, and people are interested in it. And so now what they're doing is they're arguing not just the technical aspects of the amendment, but they're also saying, you know what, this isn't really nonpartisan the way that it's being portrayed, that these are people who have a history of campaigning, donating for Democrats. Some of them, one of them has been an active Democrat for a long time. And as a matter of fact, that particular person is leaving the board to run for the county commission here in Ingham, saying that he doesn't want to become a hot point in the campaign. But what the Republicans are going to argue is that this really isn't nonpartisan. This is Democrats and progressives who don't like what fate has handed them in recent elections. And so they're trying to change the rules of the game.
Is there any other ballot campaign that, if it does get before voters in 2018, also has the potential to be very competitive and also attract money and interest from various factions of not only Michigan but around the country?
Well, a couple. There is an initiative before the legislature, or it will be soon, to ban what's known as prevailing wage. And what it is those are rules for state contracts, and a lot of local governments have them too, that say that if you're going to get a publicly financed building project, that you have to pay workers on that project the prevailing union wage for that reason. And there are groups, mostly non-union building firms, that have been trying to ban that for a long time. Building trade unions have actually responded with their own petition drive that they're hoping that they can convince the legislature just to let it all go to the ballot and let voters decide, although Republican leaders have indicated at this juncture that they're still planning to vote to adopt the prevailing wage ban if and when it is presented to them. There is also a petition drive out there to raise the minimum wage and eliminate the tipped wage disparity, the lower wage that servers and other people who work for tips can get paid. I would certainly think that that would be fiercely contested and well-funded on both sides if it makes it to the ballot.
And what about part-time legislature?
We'll see what happens. They're still collecting signatures. You know, they say they're on track, but people are wondering if they'll even, you know, get to turn them in. We'll see what happens.
We mentioned Governor Snyder at the beginning of our conversation and, of course, giving his final State of the State address later this month. And there's been some talk about how this year will be an attempt to try and cement his legacy. Is there a limit to how much he can improve his legacy given the Flint water crisis? And that will probably always be, if not in the first couple sentences of the story of his governorship, within the first paragraph or so.
I think that he's somewhat accepted that his legacy is going to be bookended by the success that was the Detroit rescue, the Detroit bailout, and the scandal that was the Flint water crisis. But he's got to, for two reasons, you know, make the argument too that, you know, Michigan has been largely an economic success on his watch, that, you know, taxes have been lowered, that more jobs, the employment picture has improved. And that's not just for his legacy, you know, just how he's remembered, but also he is really hoping that Lieutenant Governor Brian Kelly will be his successor. And that pretty much relies on people at least finding his legacy to be acceptable as a path going forward.
Rick Pluta is the Capitol Bureau Chief for the Michigan Public Radio Network. As always, thank you for your time.
Always a pleasure, Gordon.
Rick joined us from NPRN's studios in Lansing. This is WMUK's West Southwest. I'm Gordon Evans. The full effect of the recent ruling on so-called net neutrality may not be known for some time, but at a recent Kalamazoo City Commission meeting, one citizen, during public comment, and one commissioner suggested that municipal broadband is one possible way of ensuring that favorability is not granted to websites based on business decisions. We're going to discuss net neutrality and municipal broadband with Paul Carrier. He's a professor with Western Michigan University's Thomas M. Cooley Law School. His expertise includes contracts as well as public and private international law. Thank you very much for being with us.
Oh, glad to be here.
So what is the basic idea? What would prompt a government, a local government, a city, a township, et cetera, to say we're going to offer some form of municipal broadband service?
Well, the problem is this internet service seems to be such an important commodity these days that every citizen should have some reasonable access to it. And that's hard to ensure when private enterprise for profit is the one investing and then taking back the collecting the fees. And so, for example, where you have a city of a million users or potential users, that's the kind of market that that ensures a robust competition to supply those services. But if you go to smaller communities, you might see no interest in servicing those communities, or maybe just servicing certain areas like business areas, potentially leaving out quite a few people who, as we now begin to believe, have some need, if not a right, to public access internet.
So is it possible for these two different forms of broadband to coexist? In other words, we could have private companies which come in and say, well, we can set up shop in whatever city, whatever size it is, and at the same time, a local government saying, well, we're going to make sure that there is some sort of internet service that is maybe a little more affordable for people who are low income and also doesn't have any sort of favorability for one website over another.
The problem there is that what we're dealing with is something like a natural monopoly, because this kind of service requires a significant infrastructure investment. And so technically, it doesn't make a lot of sense for you to have three or four people running internet lines, fiber optic cables in the same area, okay, because that would become cost prohibitive. So it does, in a way, lead to, by definition, a single provider. Although we do see some different competition with cable companies and municipalities. The key, though, is municipalities can actually participate in several ways. Municipalities can set up their own systems, or they can set up a smaller system that piggybacks on the internet. For example, in those places where it is not cost-effective for a private concern internet service provider to put in the infrastructure, perhaps the municipality could do that and then be the link into the internet service provider where there is coverage.
In the case of private providers right now, I think that there's some concern that we've seen consolidation in the industry and that in some areas there may not be very many providers available. As you said, maybe in a bigger city you have more robust competition, but in smaller areas there may only be perhaps one provider. So is there some sort of role here in a strange way for a city government to try and ensure that there is competition?
Well, that's actually something that is a good idea. It should be done. But again, the idea behind private and for-profit companies is to be the sole provider and to avoid as much regulation as possible. And so if you look at this thing as a basic right, as a free speech issue, then perhaps it justifies the local municipal involvement, so to speak. But if you look at it as pure commerce, then some of those arguments fall by the wayside, and then the for-profit model makes sense. Now, mind you, as long as there is some level of competition, it would make sense for a local municipality to, in fact, regulate. And, for example, the current law in Michigan requires that if municipalities want to get involved in the internet business, they have to put out a request for proposals for internet companies, for cable companies to come in and to bid. And if the municipality that is putting out this request for proposal doesn't get at least three qualified proposals, then that local municipality has the ability under Michigan law to initiate its own system. If it does receive three or more qualified bids, then it's required to use the private company bid, the best one, for its under its parameters and not set up its own. And so the Michigan law right now is basically geared at ensuring that rural areas that might not have a lot of demand can still find a way to set up an internet system for the populace. But in places where there will be a certain level of competition, i.e., three or more companies that would set up bids to take over the service, then the local municipalities don't have the right under Michigan law to set up an individual system or a municipal system.
Does how you view this maybe depend on how you view internet service? That, in other words, is it now a utility like the way we would view electricity or water service that people still pay for, but there are some pretty strict guidelines under how that service can be provided and how the rates can be set?
And that's a good example because it's, in fact, often when you're talking about fiber optics or cable, those lines would piggyback existing lines or existing systems for things like phone line. And so it makes sense to treat it like a public utility. But you're right. If you look at it as a basic requirement of ordinary living, then that would justify a higher level of regulation where it is a private entity providing the services as opposed to the municipality itself.
And might it also depend here how this all gets framed in terms of which regulators have their eyes on it? If you're talking about, is this viewed as a communication and a free speech issue? Is it viewed as an issue of trade and commerce? Does it depend then, if you look at it through those two different lenses, can you end up arriving at two different places?
Yes, you can. And anytime you deal with something involving free speech, for example, you have a different constitutional right that might be involved, and arguably a human right. And so if you look at this internet access as the right of people to communicate and get their message across, where there might be no other valid ways to do so as effectively, then you have a free speech aspect. And one of the interesting aspects of the recent change in the SEC approach to net neutrality is that the FCC is in control of speech, content, and things of that ilk. The Federal Trade Commission is responsible for ensuring fair competition. And with the changes of late last year, the oversight federally of internet and service providers will in fact be done now by the Federal Trade Commission, making it more of a commerce issue than by the FCC, which is more of a speech-oriented regulatory body. And so, yes, the answer is yes. If you look at it as an important right of speech, there would be a stronger argument of populace for, you know, a stronger set of regulatory parameters to control what the level of access, the speed, the price, the packaging.
Is it possible for a local government to put down conditions for a private internet service provider? In other words, say, if you're going to do business in our city, then, you know, we expect you to follow certain net neutrality guidelines. Or is it more difficult than that, more complicated than that? You know, are there limits as to what a city or township can do in terms of setting conditions for someone to provide internet service?
Well, what you're talking about now is what the law likes to call an exaction, where the government has some regulatory control and allows a private entity to move in. For example, a developer putting in a new zoning development, a new housing project. The government does have the right, in fact, to demand exaction. For example, you will put in all the roads necessary and then donate them to the municipality as part of our government approval to put in this housing development. And so the precedent for government entities to expect exactions or that quid pro quo is certainly out there. There are efforts right now in a fair number of states to, in fact, prevent that, however.
And presumably the big internet service providers are going to be in favor of putting limits on that, right? They're going to want the ability to provide the service as they see fit.
That's correct. Regulation is the bane of the for-profit industry. And in fact, there are significant lobbying efforts right now. I know of some on the federal level, but I'm sure they exist on the state level, to avoid the increasing regulation by local municipalities.
Professor Carrier, thank you very much for your time. Paul Carrier is a professor with Western Michigan University's Thomas M. Cooley Law School. This is WMUK's West Southwest. I'm Gordon Evans.